RVS.
Good afternoon. It's 3 p.m. Weather for the KRVS listening area. Sunny this afternoon with a high near 88 degrees, northeast winds at 5 miles per hour. This evening, patchy fog in the early hours, otherwise mostly clear with a low of 64. On Friday, a sunny day with a high near 90. Currently, it's fair and 88 here on the campus of UL Lafayette. Coming up later this hour, we've got Daryl Borks from the Poets Bookshelf segment coming up. And at 4 o'clock, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. We're going to begin by heading into the interview studio with Judith Merriweather.
Joining me by telephone from New Orleans is writer James Nolan. His novel Higher Ground has just been published by the UL Lafayette Press. It is their very first novel. They have been publishing for many years now. They have published some fiction, but this is their very first novel. And how wonderful that they chose your novel, James, about New Orleans, again called Higher Ground. You also have a collection of short stories called Perpetual Care that won a lot of notice and awards, and I'm sure many people in our audience have encountered that book. You also just recently won an award for Higher Ground. It was the 2012 Independent Publishers Book Award Gold Medal in Southern Fiction.
Yeah,
you should be, because there is a lot of Southern fiction out there. They have a lot to choose from.
The novel was also awarded the William Faulkner Wisdom Gold Medal in 2008 in manuscript form.
Congratulations on that.
Which was one of the things that inspired me to definitely try to get it published.
That's right, to continue with it. Now, James, you're from New Orleans.
Yes, I am. Mm-hmm. I was born and raised here, and my family goes back five or six generations. So, really, I was the first person who ever left.
No one saw any reason to leave.
I did leave for about 25 or 30 years, and it was very, very nice to have some place to come home to, I think. And I think that's what the novel, in some ways, is about. It's about a sense of home,
mm-hmm.
about a sense of home under incredible duress,
yeah.
but a sense of home nonetheless.
Right. Well, tell us about your early experience of that home growing up there. Early stories from New Orleans are always fascinating, childhood perceptions of that town.
Well, I was born actually during a hurricane in 1947, the hurricane that devastated New Orleans, and our first home was in the Treme, only a few blocks from where 3,000 people were being sheltered from that hurricane, and that was the hurricane that inspired the government to build the federal levees that failed during Katrina. And it also was the basis for the building of Lakeview and of New Orleans East for the returning GIs from World War II on the GI Bill. But we grew up in the 7th Ward, and it was a mixed neighborhood, a very friendly, safe neighborhood. And my real shock on coming home is how unsafe New Orleans now is. I remember that my grandfather, also an insomniac like I am, but sometimes couldn't get to sleep at 3 a.m. So in his slippers and bathrobe, he would walk from Columbus to Esplanade Avenue and back at 3 a.m. And this was an 80-something-year-old white man.
Mm.
So that's how safe New Orleans, the New Orleans was I grew up in.
Yeah. There's a lovely detail in Higher Ground that sounds like it kind of came from your own grandfather, an older man. Well, what do you remember about New Orleans? Aside from your neighborhood being safe, what were your sharpest memories of growing up there?
That the intergenerational families,
mm-hmm.
because at one point, I think we lived with my great-grandparents, who were French Creoles, originally from Alsace-Lorraine and Brussels. My grandparents, my parents, my teenage aunt, and we all lived together in half of a shotgun house.
Mm.
So there was no privacy at all. But there was no such thing as daycare or nursing homes, because daycare was called mamère, grandma. So there was an incredible sense of, and there were always drunk uncles and lots of spinster aunts who lived around the corner in an old plantation house on Valley Road. And so it was more like a Chekhov story than like Leave It to Beaver. or the 50s sitcoms that I started watching on television, when I immediately thought that there was something really wrong with my life.
It didn't look like that.
It didn't. My life didn't look like that at all. It was like watching a German program from Haiti or something. And I began to realize that New Orleans was quite a different place. And I remember when I went away to college for the first time in Florida, I was shocked that there was no Mardi Gras, that there was no live music, and that the food was barely edible.
But yet you were eager to leave New Orleans as, I guess, a teenager. You were heading, kind of mentally already heading out. Well, what
right.
lured you away?
Well, I thought New Orleans was a very backward place, and it certainly was. The racial violence and the racist attitude here was very, very oppressive. And it also seemed extremely provincial and backward to me. Mm-hmm. It seemed like a real backwater. So I had my sights set on the literary bohemian world of New York and San Francisco. And, of course, once I went to Paris, I spent years living. I lived in Barcelona for 10 years. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to be in a more progressive cosmopolitan atmosphere. But eventually I grew tired of being a guest at other people's parties and wanted to come back to my own home. Mm-hmm. And it was actually coming back. Before that, I was a poet and a translator and an essayist. And I wrote a book of literary criticism about Pablo Neruda. And, you know, I got a PhD in couplet at Berkeley and was all set to be sort of an international traveler professor. And when I came home to New Orleans is when I started telling stories. Mm-hmm. There was something about hearing my own language and with the cadences of New Orleans. And every time I walked out of my house, another short story happened to me. I didn't go looking for it. It just happened to me.
Mm-hmm.
And there was something about the oral nature of New Orleans storytelling that inspired me to become a fiction writer.
Mm-hmm. Well, what drew you? You were tired of, I guess, being always a guest at someone else's party, but were there family things that drew you back to New Orleans?
Specifically, yes. Mm-hmm. My mother was ill and remained ill for quite some time.
Mm-hmm.
So I came back as a visiting writer in residence at Tulane University. And I was came back intending to spend one semester here and move back to my apartment in San Francisco or go back to Barcelona. But I just enjoyed living here so much, and I enjoyed the, you know, as I always say, the one thing that you can't buy in life is belonging. And I felt I belonged here.
Mm-hmm.
And it inspired me to write about the place. And so I was very, very hesitant to leave this place of belonging that gave me so much rich material.
And you were just starting to tell your own stories.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I did leave once briefly. I moved back to Madrid after 9/11 because I thought the country was hysterical. But my mother at that point was gravely ill, so I came back, and I've been here really ever since 2002, permanently.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's so interesting that while you were traveling and teaching in various universities, you were dealing with other people's stories, translating, writing about other poets, and that you really didn't find that voice until you came back.
It was here waiting for me.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think there's something, you know, the Native Americans say that you belong where the bones of your ancestors are buried.
Mm.
So there's a definitely vertical connection between me and New Orleans on both sides of my family, both the Irish side, my father's side, and the French Creole side, my mother's side.
Mm. I want to tell people who may just be tuning in, my guest by telephone from New Orleans is writer James Nolan. UL Lafayette Press has published his novel, Higher Ground. It is their first novel, and quite an honor to have published James's book, which has been winning awards. Previously, you'd published a collection of short stories. Was the collection of short stories Perpetual Care, that came after Katrina?
No, that came before Katrina, yes. And that was my first attempts at actually seriously writing and publishing fiction. There's one post-Katrina story at the very end, but that was published in 2008. So even though it was published after Katrina, most of the vision of the city is a pre-Katrina vision.
Mm. And are most of the stories based upon characters from the city?
Yeah, very much so. And mm-hmm. I live in the French Quarter, so as I say, all I have to do is walk out of my front gate, and there is a story and a character waiting mm-hmm. for me. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it is not exactly autobiographical, but I drew things from my past mm-hmm. and write from the perspective of a child in several stories.
Mm. Well, a novel is different than short story, and is this your first completed novel? Higher Ground?
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. And really, it was Katrina that drew it out of me. Yeah. I had never really intended to write a novel, mm-hmm. but when I came back from my various evacuations, you know, we weren't allowed in for a couple of months. And so I was in Baton Rouge at Andre Codrescu's house. I was in Florida at a friend's house, and then went back to Barcelona for a month. And I came back, and I just really realized that I would either write a novel, go crazy, or leave the place. Mm. Those were my three choices. Mm-hmm. So I wrote the novel, and I didn't want to write another pathetic disaster story. This novel begins 5 months after the storm, mm-hmm. in January of 2006. And so it's basically, I think the real human drama is when people are sorting out the wreckage of their lives.
Right.
During a disaster, people are either surviving or unfortunately not surviving, but it's months later.
And it's quite funny. The book is funny.
Well, and I didn't want to write a pathetic book about Katrina, and New Orleanians are funny people. Mm-hmm. And so there was an enormous amount of gallows humor at that time of people dealing with their FEMA trailers and their insurance companies and their lost loved ones and the absolute chaos that surrounded us, not to mention the politics at that time. So the novel is a satiric romp through the city, everything from Mardi Gras that year to the mayoral election, which I also feature, which was a real turning point in the city at that time.
All whose names are carefully changed to protect the innocent.
To protect the innocent, yes. The mayor is called Roy Blinger.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, you have a passage that you selected to read. Could you read that for us?
Yeah, this is somewhere in the middle of the novel, and Nicole, one of my protagonists, has just come home to live in New Orleans for the first time after 30 years away. And she's living next door to her mother in the French Quarter, the mother on one side, the daughter on the other, in the traditional manner. And she's very concerned about her mother because her mother, in order to pay the rent, is pushing pills in a French Quarter gay bar. Her mother is 76 years old. So she and her Auntie Dixie, the mother's sister, take it upon themselves to go to a social worker and try to stage what's called an intervention, in which they will confront the mother about her felonious activities in the French Quarter. The mother, of course, is having the time of her life. And at one point, after they come back from the social worker, they run into a empty Mardi Gras parade. And I'll begin here. When they turned onto Chapatula Street, a dimly lit street of abandoned warehouses running along the river, they found themselves stuck behind the empty floats of a disbanded parade, rumbling back to the barn. Their headlights illuminated the float in front of them, one bearing a wobbly caricature of Mayor Blinger dressed as Moses. He was carrying a stone tablet marked FEMA and pointing the way through tinselly red waves. On the rear of the float was a scroll that read, "Let my people go." How in the dickens did we wind up behind this mess? Auntie Dixie lit another Kent. "Doesn't this just say it all?" Nicole said, starting to tear. It was as if she were part of some funeral cortege for the city, stuck behind the riderless floats of a carnival of a parade, lumbering through the darkness, undoubtedly following the FEMA dump trucks that she counted every day as they carted off the soggy possessions of the dead and the gone. These days, Nicole couldn't separate herself from an end-of-the-world feeling. It followed her as she peered into the plate glass windows of closed storefronts, empty, but with huge, now-open banners strung out front. As she called one disconnected phone number after another, as she drove along the spectral streets of her childhood, following the water lines on the rotting houses, as she stepped out of the shower in the morning and realized she couldn't do a single thing she'd planned during the day because the stores and offices and restaurants weren't there anymore. And when she did arrive at those few places where she could go, the bank was out of money and the gas station out of gas and the supermarket out of bread and onions. At these moments, it dawned on Nicole what she'd run out of, a future. I couldn't wait to come home, but now I don't know what to do. Nicole pointed through the windshield to the corner. Annie Dixie, look at that broken traffic light manically blinking go and don't go at the same time. That's the mixed message I get everywhere in this crazy town. Stay, leave, stay, leave. I don't know whether to plant a live oak tree that will take 100 years to grow or to start packing my suitcase tonight. Red, green, red, green. It would be hard enough if the instructions were clear, stay or go, fight or flight. But day after day, getting both signals at once? You can't just make yourself up at some U-Haul office. Dixie took an impatient suck on the Kent, the wrinkles puckering around her ruby lips. Girl, you're from somewhere. Not like those lost souls spinning around on the freeways with nowhere to go. You don't seem to appreciate what we tried so hard to give you, a place to call home. Face it, Nicole said, eyes brimming. One day I'll come knocking at your door, or Mama's, and strangers will be living there. And the love of my life will be off in Mexico, I don't know, selling fish sticks. And here I'll be, working some dead-end job, old and alone in a shabby rental with broken pipes and a leaky roof, still waiting for the city to turn itself around, for that flashing red light to finally turn green. And you know something? The only green lights left in this town are like the ones at the end of the Great Gatsby, lights from the past. I don't give a rat's ass what color the light is, but I'm moving this crate down the road. Dixie blasted her horn at the stalled floats and then sped around them straight through the intersection with the broken light. Some of us don't have a choice. We were born here and we'll croak here no matter what the stupid traffic light says, which we never pay no attention to anyway. She reached over to squeeze Nicole's shoulder. Where else can you see a Hermes parade? For years, I dreamed of coming home for Mardi Gras, Nicole said. But now with Marky dead and Mama like she is and city half gone. Honey, don't you know the worse you feel, the better Mardi Gras is? We don't celebrate because we don't have any problems, but because we got too many. Dixie threw back her head and laughed. So this year is going to be a humdinger. So that's the end of the 11th chapter.
And if you've just tuned in, you've been listening to James Nolan reading from his latest work, his novel, Higher Ground. Dixie's a brilliant character.
She's my Cruella de Vil. And I think any good novel needs a villain, and she's kind of the villain, a lovable villain, but definitely the villain. And she's Nicole's mother's older sister who lives on State Street and is doing just fine because she has a maid and lives three blocks from Langenstein's grocery store. Mm-hmm. And she cannot understand why her little sister wants to live in that rat hole of the French Quarter.
Mm. You know what interested me the most is that you, of course, when you write a story, write a novel, you have to choose very specific characters. You have to choose a story. You're making choices. And obviously, it's not everybody's experience. But you ended up creating that sense of finally coming to understand that New Orleans is home, no matter what people's experiences were, that so many of them went through those very same emotions and just bizarre situations.
Well, one thing about disasters is that it breaks down barriers between mm-hmm. people, class and race and neighborhood barriers. So people really came together quite a bit in New Orleans, and there was a sense of we were building the new New Orleans mm-hmm. Across all kinds of barriers. And also, we're including new kinds of people, like the Mexican immigrants that came here to help us rebuild, mm-hmm. who are now being Creolized and are part of the New Orleans experience. And at all the music festivals, there's salsa music and there are crawfish tacos. So we're including other people in the ongoing creolization of what it means to be in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. The one thing I think the novel doesn't have is they're no tourists, because of course after Katrina, the city was tourism was toast here. Mm-hmm. And someone asked me in an interview, the city feels so magical, and I've been there before, but it never felt that magical. And I think the reason is that the fun factory was closed. Mm. We had no festivals, we had no tourism, we had no sightseeing buses. It was just us New Orleanians. Mm-hmm. And I think it's rarer to read a New Orleans book that doesn't contain some echoes of the commercial fun factory that the city has become.
Yeah, it was like a pure distilled essence of New Orleans reading your book.
Exactly, without the quotation marks around the identity of the city, which mm-hmm. tourism puts there.
Right. Now, this book is available everywhere through UL Press. How can people get a hold of it?
Oh, it's available in most most local bookstores mm-hmm. in southern Louisiana, and then, of course, it's on Amazon and Barnes & Noble websites, and it's also available as an e-book. Mm-hmm. But I'm very proud of the cover, and I would really appreciate people buying the actual book, because we mm-hmm. put a lot of time and effort into making it a beautiful book.
Yeah, the cover is a painting called Marty Gross.
It's by a gentleman artist, Warrington Colescott, who is family roots in New Orleans, and who I saw his work at a retrospective at the Museum of Art here and just fell in love with it. And it has the same satirical tone as the novel does. And I'm very impressed with Mr. Colescott because he's 92 years old mm-hmm. and he still has a condo here in the French Quarter where he comes for Jazz Fest. So we definitely understand each other very well. So I don't know if the e-book, I think the e-book might have the cover inside, mm-hmm. but it's certainly a different experience.
Well, and I would also say that every book I've ever held that the UL Press has published is a beautiful book. It feels good. The pages, the paper they use, it's a pleasure just to hold it in your hand. So
They put a lot of care and attention into producing beautiful books and in choosing the right books to reflect Louisiana culture. And it's been a great pleasure to work with them. They've really taken up, the gauntlet of publishing Louisiana material. I don't know what LSU is doing now, mm-hmm. but most of the Louisiana-themed books are published by the University of Mississippi Press. Mm-hmm. So UL Press has really filled in a very, very important role in publishing Louisiana culture, history, and fiction.
Right. And you can go to their website to find out more about all of their other titles, as well as to find out more about James Nolan's Higher Ground. Again, winner of the Faulkner Wisdom Gold Medal, and just recently a gold medal for Southern Fiction from the Independent Publishers Books Association. So kudos to you and the UL Press as well. My guest, James Nolan, has joined me by telephone from New Orleans talking about his latest work, a novel called Higher Ground, published by the UL Lafayette Press. So are you at work on other stories now, James?
I have a new collection of short stories, of New Orleans mm-hmm. short stories, which is called You Don't Know Me.
Mm.
and many of them, which are set in French Quarter courtyards. Yeah.
We look forward to that one, and perhaps we'll have you back live in our studios for that book.
I would enjoy coming back to Lafayette. I was there last week for the International Festival, and it was a great experience.
Mm.
So that's where I'm going from now on, instead of the first weekend of Jazz Fest.
All right. We look forward to having you here. Thank you so much, James, for joining us.
Thank you, Judith, very much. Pleasure talking.
It is Thursday afternoon when KRVS presents From the Poet's Bookshelf with Louisiana poet Darryl Bourque, reading works by writers from or inspired by Louisiana.
Today's first poem is by Megan Burns, and the poem is from Improbable Worlds, an anthology of Texas and Louisiana poets edited by Martha Serpas. Megan Burns is the editor of the poetry magazine Solid Quarter. She lives in New Orleans, where she and her husband, poet Dave Brinks, run the weekly 17 Poets Literary and Performance series. Megan Burns' poem, To Mother. We live a lot these days in the margins of survival, a smoking tower or a river jumping its bounds. The news never lets us forget our little lives are an anomaly. To walk hand in hand to the park and not drop dead from pesticides, carcinogens, bullets dropping like slaps of hail, wailing, the mother's second voice. I think about the baby that fell from its mother's grasp off a rooftop into dirty water that islanded them, the small body slipping under, simple as an embrace, a wish while the rescue chopper descended. How do you not go down into the underworld looking for your dead? What if my arms are slippery when the time comes to hold tight? I try to make sure my place at the table of loss is already filled. My heart never recovers. By some magic, these bodies built, some nights I ride out on the pitch of their frail sleep, dreaming of a different kind of knowing. And the second poem today is by Jericho Brown, who worked as a speechwriter for the mayor of New Orleans before receiving his PhD in creative writing and literature from University of Houston. He holds an MFA from the University of New Orleans and a BA from Dillard University. Jericho Brown, from Improbable Worlds, an anthology of Texas and Louisiana poets, edited by Martha Serpas. To be seen. You will forgive me if I carry the tone of a preacher. Surely you understand a man in the midst of dying must have a point, which is not to say that I'm dying exactly. My doctor tells me I might live longer than most, since I see him more than most. Of course, he cannot be trusted, nor can any man who promises you life based on his being seen. Understand also, then, that a point and a message are quite different. Messages come from the chosen, a lunatic, an angel, the whitest dove, those who hear the voice of God and other good music. A point, on the other hand, is made by one who chooses but claims to have been chosen so as not to be punished for bringing bad news. A preacher, a poet, the doctor, men who talk about God because they want to speak in metaphors. My doctor, for instance, insists on the metaphor of war. It's always the virus that attacks and the cells that fight or die fighting. I even remember him saying the word siege when another rash returned. Here I am, dying while he makes a battle of my body. Anything to be seen when all he really means is to grab me by the chin and, like God the Father, say through clenched teeth, "Look at me when I'm talking to you. Your healing is not in my hands, though I touch as if to make you whole." ¶¶
KRVS each Thursday afternoon for From the Poet's Bookshelf with Louisiana poet Darryl Bork. Joining me in the KRVS studios this afternoon is author Ben Sanmel. His book, Ernie Cato, the R&B Emperor of New Orleans, has just been published by the Historic New Orleans Collection. It is part of their series, the second in their series, called the Louisiana Musician Series. And it is a gorgeous book, Ben.
Oh, thank you.
Absolutely gorgeous.
Thank you.
I want to tell our listeners, some of whom may know you in various capacities, Ben is a journalist, he's a folklorist, a drummer, and producer. I think there are people in this area who may have seen you drumming.
With the Hackberry Ramblers.
With the Hackberry Ramblers. Some people may have seen you doing your folklore work in various capacities, interviewing people. Your articles on Louisiana music have appeared nationally in journals like The Atlantic. Fabulous articles. They've been collected in anthologies. You have written the liner notes for over 100 albums.
Yes.
All varieties of Louisiana music, primarily.
Louisiana music, well, national music, bluegrass, country music, gospel, rockabilly, and Louisiana music, Cajun and Zydeco and Swamp Pop.
Absolutely. Those are all going to be collected in a book someday, I'm sure. You also wrote a wonderful book called Zydeco with an exclamation mark. The photographs for that book were taken by Rick Olivier.
Rick Olivier, yeah.
And,
collaborative book.
The text, yeah. And you have produced and played on 4 albums, including the Grammy-nominated Deep,
Deep Water.
By the Hackberry Ramblers.
Yes.
And you were a drummer with that group. As well, as we just learned, you are now getting your master's in musicology at Tulane.
Yes.
So you've been a real busy person over the past
many
years.
I have been a busy guy, yes.
Yeah. Well, now you've been living in New Orleans probably since the early 80s.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. What drew you to New Orleans originally?
Well, two things. I used to work on boats on the Mississippi River as a deckhand, and we would stop in New Orleans. Actually, we would end the trip in New Orleans and then turn around and go back. So during my time off, I would explore the city, and I was really attracted to it. And then I started getting interested in Louisiana music. I'd actually first heard Cajun music. I lived for 2 years as a teenager in England. And blues and a lot of esoteric indigenous styles are more popular in Europe than they are where I grew up in Cincinnati. So I was exposed to Cajun music then. And one day I was off the boat and took a ride out around Raceland and Houma, that area, and went to a little bar to shoot pool. And there on the jukebox was a 45 that I had seen, or a song that I had seen as an album track on what I thought was a really obscure collector's album. And here was this same song as a 45 in a jukebox, and it just occurred to me, this is really a living culture. This is not a museum piece or a genre of music that's just reserved for record geeks and collectors, but this is what people really listen to day to day, and that really impressed me.
What was the song?
Ooh, might have been Pine Grove Blues by Nathan Absher.
That has a way of hooking you in.
Yeah, or it might have been Sugar Bee by Cleveland Crochet. Mm-hmm. It was one of those two.
So it was a moment that led to a very long journey.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, so you ended up in New Orleans,
yes.
Learning more about the music, the culture,
yes.
And you began writing about Louisiana culture and music very quickly.
Yeah, my first assignment was to do an article on Clifton Chenier. So I came out here, and it took a while to get him to sit down for the interview, a week, actually. And so I started getting acquainted with a lot of people in the music and the cultural community through that. And everything that followed came from there.
Mm. Well, tell us about your relationship with Ernie Cato. Where did you first encounter him?
Well, I first heard Ernie Cato's music as a kid, which so many people did, because Mother-in-Law was a huge hit. And I was 9 years old in 1961 when Mother-in-Law came out.
Okay, I'm going to ask if you could. I've told a couple people, Ben Sanmel's coming to talk about Ernie Cato. And a lot of people go, Ernie Cato?
Okay,
and
who is Ernie Cato?
Not only that, but as soon as I sing like the first line, they
exactly.
know immediately.
Exactly. And the funny thing is that first line is actually not sung by Ernie Cato. It's sung by the backup singer, Benny Spellman. And everyone I interviewed for the book, the same thing. I would go, Ernie Cato, and they go, mother-in-law. Not that I'm a singer. Right, right. But that opening line was not by Cato. And so after the record was a huge hit, Benny Spellman, not completely unreasonably, thought that he had made it a hit, because in the record business, that's called a hook. Mm-hmm. And he was the one who had provided the hook, and he demanded more pay and equal billing. And he and Cato actually got in a fist fight at a recording session, and Alan Toussaint had to send them home for the day.
So I'm sure that is one of the moments you describe in this book.
That is. But backing up for those 99.9% for whom Cato is not a household mm-hmm. name, he was a rhythm and blues singer from New Orleans, a very good rhythm and blues singer who emerged in the peak of what is called retroactively the golden age of New Orleans rhythm and blues. And this is the era of Fats Domino and Lloyd Price, and then a little bit later, Dr. John and the Neville Brothers. And Cato had one big national hit entitled Mother-in-Law in 1961. It was number one on both the pop and R&B charts. And it was the first number one record recorded in New Orleans by a New Orleans musician. And actually, Fats Domino, for all his incredible success, never had a number one record per se. And Ernie Cato made a lot of good records before then and a lot of good records after then, and none of them were hits. And it's, some people have described him as a one-hit wonder, which I find disparaging and inaccurate, and it really doesn't take into account all the many complex figures that enable a record to be a hit or not make it. So it's a very arbitrary kind of process, and it's not really a commentary on the quality of the music. Mm-hmm. Either way, I mean, a lot of pretty mediocre records hit, and some very good ones don't.
Well, we're going to go back into his history in just a moment. I want to tell people again who may just be tuning in. My guest, Ben Sandmel, has just published his book, Ernie Cato, The R&B Emperor of New Orleans, with the Historic New Orleans Collection. It's a part of their musician series. It is an absolutely gorgeous book. Beautiful writing, beautiful photographs. They spared nothing in producing this book.
They really didn't.
Really gorgeous. So you remember hearing that hit back in the 60s.
Yeah.
When did you first encounter Ernie Cato in New Orleans?
Well, I went to, before I moved to New Orleans, I went to Jazz Fest one year around 1978, and he was playing in a little club, and I went to see him. There was hardly anybody there, which amazed me, because to me this guy was a star, a legend, and he was doing all the dance steps made famous by James Brown, all the sliding across the stage on one foot and doing all the tricks with the microphone to make the microphone jump back and forth on its stand. Kind of standard soul music stagecraft, but he was very good at it. And I introduced myself during the break, and he was friendly enough, but not really effusive, I would say. And didn't really think much about him after that. In the mid-80s, he had a radio show in New Orleans, and he would rant and rave and mostly play his own records and then scream over them about what a genius he was. So I heard this show sometimes. I didn't have an FM radio at that time, but I did hear it enough to get a sense of him.
An impression on you.
Made a big impression on
me. What radio station was it on?
WWOZ, and then for a little while he was on WTUL at Tulane, and then back on OZ as a guest, but not as the host of his own show. But there was a time when they sort of put him off the air at OZ because he was sort of out of control, and also they had a policy that you couldn't give plugs for people's businesses or their personal appearances, and he would do that. But he had a huge following. It was a very popular show.
And you enjoyed listening to it.
I did. I did. I know some of those tapes by heart. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but I do.
I think I remember you sending some to us
years
and years ago.
Yeah,
it's
kind of like leaving Bibles in motel rooms. You know?
That's right. Little Ernie Cato cassettes.
Right. But as far as getting to know him, his wife opened a club for him in the mid-90s, the Mother-in-Law Lounge. Because at that point, before he hooked up with his second wife, he had really gone downhill, and he was living the life of a derelict out on the street, sleeping underneath the Claiborne Bridge. And she picked him up and cleaned him up and opened up this club, because at that point, no other place in New Orleans would take a chance on hiring him, because he might show up drunk, wearing somebody else's clothes. I saw him doing that once, wearing a suit that was three or four times too big for him. He might not show up at all. He still might do a great show, but it's very unpredictable. So I started going to this club, this tiny little club, and the atmosphere there was so first it was so warm and hospitable, but at the same time it was really surreal, like walking into the set of a Fellini movie. And I just found it fascinating. And the combination of music and the combination of people going through as a middle-aged black audience, Cato's contemporaries, and these young, I don't know if this is the correct term, slacker kids, you know, with green hair and body piercings and everything. And everybody was bellied up to the bar together and everybody got along. It's very harmonious.
Mm-hmm.
And I started getting more and more fascinated by the scene there. And I produced the oral history stage at the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival. So I had Cato on there as an interviewee one year. And his wife told me that he felt comfortable with me and that it seems that I understood him, which could be a scary thing. But we got to be pretty good friends. And then the following year, Nick Spitzer of American Roots mm-hmm. hosted a big 4th of July concert at the base of the Washington Monument. And Cato was on the show. And I got an assignment from Michael Tisserand, who was then the editor of Gambit, to do a piece on this trip. And we called it Mr. Cato Goes to Washington. So I flew up with Cato and his singers and dancers and his band and spent a couple days with them, wrote a piece for Gambit. And that's when I realized that everything that was going on around him and the scene really was way past the confines of a magazine article mm-hmm. and really called for a book.
Mm.
So it kind of started there. That's around 1999.
Okay, and he passed away
in 2001. Yes.
So after you got this idea to write the book, you had a couple years, really, to spend with him. And
well, at the time, though, I wasn't a front burner project. Mm-hmm. I was writing the Zydeco book, and I was very busy with the Hackberry Ramblers, and I didn't know, nobody knew that Cato was very ill. Mm-hmm. In fact, up till the last, he was always hatching new schemes. And in the spring of 2001, I think it was, he told me or suggested, he said, you know, you really ought to write a book about me. And that resonated. And so we had made a plan to go around New Orleans through his old neighborhood with a videographer, and he would just reminisce. And that was July 4th weekend, 2001, and I was out on the road with the Hackberry Ramblers, and that's when he went into the hospital and passed away.
Mm-hmm.
So I did have three interviews with him that I had done, and I had a lot of the WWOZ tapes, and other people were nice enough to let me use their interviews. So I had a lot of material with him, not nearly as much as I wanted. I would have loved to have. You're familiar with the Jelly Roll Morton interview with the Library of Congress, which is 8 or 10 hours. I would have loved to have done something like that. But I did have a lot of first-hand material with Cato and a lot of things that I had observed that weren't recorded as interviews, but just things that I remembered. And I interviewed a lot of his colleagues from every phase of his career and his relatives and did quite a bit of research.
Mm-hmm. So you had a lot of material when he passed away.
Yes.
But you said, actually, it's fortunate that you didn't find a publisher until a year or so.
Well, I had some material when he passed away, but not a book's worth. And I started working on the book in the fall of 2001. And by, I think, the next spring, I had a book proposal, and I was sending it around to publishers and working with an agent for a while, and it just kept getting rejected. And I was still very busy with the band then, the Hackberry Ramblers, and working on a documentary that was broadcast on PBS. So the Cato project was still on the back burner. And then after Katrina, we played what was obviously our last show in Baton Rouge, because they were getting really frail. And that's when I started to focus on the book and make it my priority and continued to try and get a deal, which wasn't forthcoming at all. But I decided that if I waited for ideal circumstances and to get a book contract, and this was coincidentally right at the time when the book business was starting to really fall apart because of the internet and people weren't paying advances like they used to and expecting everyone to write for nothing and et cetera, et cetera. I decided to go ahead and write the book because the people that I wanted to interview were all getting on, and I figured they might pass away before I could get a chance to talk to them. Mm-hmm. So I wrote the book on spec and finished the first draft in 2008 and went back and looked at it and decided, you know, needed a lot of work, and finished the second draft in 2009 and gave the manuscript to different people, and I had been, by that point, on the Historic New Orleans Collection softball team for about 4 or 5 years.
That's the way you get books published.
That's right. So I knew them, you know. So I think that, you know, that probably helped in making them maybe a little more receptive to looking at it. Certainly wouldn't convince them to accept it, but they did. They read through it, and they liked it, and the board approved it, and here we are.
They thought they could make a home run with it, and I wish on radio we could just put this book up to the camera. It's absolutely beautiful. And, you know, one of the press releases ends with somebody walking into the mother-in-law lounge and kind of looking around and saying, there's a whole lot of love here.
Yes.
And I get that feeling when I read through this book as
well. Thank you.
There's a whole lot of love going on. Tell us what you enjoyed so much about Ernie Cato, getting to know him. I mean, obviously you'd heard his music back in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
What was it about him that endeared
him
to you?
Well, he was a nice guy. He was a very considerate guy. And he was also a very unpredictable guy who would say very off-the-wall things just off the top of his head in a very creative use of language that fascinated me. And part of it was based in a lot of African-American folkloric tradition, but part of it was just his own creation, and people would look at him stupefied at some of the things he'd come up with and the words that he would invent or the words that he would give completely new meanings to, such as naugahyde, which was kind of a general expression for sexuality. And then he started calling himself Mr. Naugahyde, and then he started calling himself Mr. Monaugahyde, the. And no one had a clue what he's talking about, and you'd ask him, you know, what does this mean? And he'd just look at you and say, well, you won't find that in Weber's dictionary. So he was never dull.
Well, and you know, you pay homage to that in this book because
Yes. It's
not dull either.
Oh, well,
and
thank
I know
you.
that meant a lot to you to really portray that sense of him, that loving eccentricity.
Loving eccentricity, mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell us about the mother-in-law lounge, because that seems to have really brought life back to him.
Oh, it did, absolutely.
Himself and so many other people.
Yeah, and it was a great crossroads and watering hole for the music community. A tiny little place, a room maybe about 30 feet by 30 feet, not very big. Always had confetti and stars hanging from the ceiling as if there was a perpetual party going on. Pictures of musicians and some of his cultural heroes, and one obscure musician named Peg Leg Moffat, who was a one-legged R&B singer who had a composite publicity photo with three shots of him. And if you look closely at the shots, the peg was not always on the same leg. And that always kind of killed me. I mean, obviously it was a reverse negative, but In the context of the lounge, you know, sort of anything seemed possible.
And this was Antoinette who really decorated.
Yes, Antoinette Cato, his second wife.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And did he actually perform?
He performed, just about every Sunday night. Sometimes he would perform behind the bar. He would sing karaoke to his own records, and he had this horribly distorted cab dispatcher's microphone that would only work if you pressed down on a button with your thumb, and he would sing along to his records. But on Sunday nights he would perform an early set with a keyboardist who was also a great Elvis impersonator named Rico Watts, and they had an electronic drum machine that accompanied them, and they could never get it to work. And so the de facto first set of every Sunday night was them fooling around with this machine and plugging things in and ripping the cords out and these big squeals of feedback, and it got to take on kind of a Laurel
like
and Hardy.
It was a show itself.
It was a show in itself, and the same next week, they'd start all over again. They had no idea how to set this thing, and they'd ask the audience for help, and Cato would be getting really frazzled and annoyed. But it turned out being part of the act,
right.
Unintentionally, but it was. But they never started the set without a set's worth of fooling around with the drum machine.
Well, it's
just
kind of like,
me.
I guess it was like his home. I mean, didn't they live upstairs?
They lived upstairs, and for a while, Antoinette's mother, who had Alzheimer's, was sitting on a couch coloring in cartoon books. And
so
everybody,
the mother-in-law was actually in the mother-in-law.
Not the mother-in-law that was sung about right. in the song, but Cato's mother-in-law, yes. Yes, she was there. So it was very much like going into somebody's house, physically and also in terms of the hospitality. She'd usually have a pot of red beans and rice cooking. She's very maternal, didn't want anybody to leave without eating.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a very welcoming place, a musically fascinating place, a lot of major historic figures of New Orleans rhythm and blues would stop in, and they were his old buddies on a first-name basis. And then you might get a busload of blue-haired suburban ladies coming back from a big night at the casino, and they drop in, or a gay group from a birthday party. Winos from the street would walk in and be treated with great respect and consideration. It was just a great mixture of people.
Mm. And even after he passed away, she kept the mother-in-law lounge open.
She kept it open for 8 years, and it including renovating it after Katrina. And then she died on Mardi Gras Day 2009, and the club stayed open for about another year and a half, but it's been closed since Christmas of 2010. Mm. So it's a big loss to the music community.
Well, your description is very colorful, but one of the great things about this book is that people can actually see the lounge.
About 150 photos and
gorgeous
reproductions of business cards and posters and everything, yeah.
Even old photographs of him as a child.
Yes, yes.
Lead on all the way up. And some great color photos of the statue that Antoinette put in the mother-in-law lounge of him.
After he died, yeah, nobody could quite figure that out if it was some sort of a form of grieving or something, but she created a statue of Ernie Cato made from a department store mannequin and modeled to look more or less like his face, and then she would dress it in different stage outfits that he had worn in real life, and she would unscrew the hands and take them for a manicure each week. And there was a little radio transmitter inside the head of this dummy or statue or mannequin, and if you rode around the block outside the lounge with your AM radio set to 1500, which was the address of the lounge, 1500 North Claiborne, you'd get a continual tape loop of Ernie Catoisms, like "I'm cocky, but I'm good," and "You know you can't dress as good as I," and stuff like
something
that.
Something out of the R&B Twilight Zone.
It was a Twilight Zone, but in a very pleasant way, a very entertaining way. It's a place that, well, as the quote said, you know, there's a lot of love in this place. Mm. It was a place that cheered a lot of people up and made a lot of people feel welcome, not just me.
Well, your book allows us all to participate in that. Those of us who never went to the mother-in-law lounge, and the only way we know Ernie Cato is when somebody sings mother-in-law.
That's right.
But this book is beautiful. It brings him alive and that whole scene that he grew up in, as you mentioned, the golden age of New Orleans.
And he spent a lot of time on the Baton Rouge blues scene, too, which I didn't realize. I'm sure he played out here. And a lot of his relatives on his father's side were French-speaking from Pointe-Coupe Parish. So he played, I think, at Richard's or Slim's in Opelousas. Mm. So a lot of very, you know, specifically Lafayette area connections.
Well, your book may inspire people to find some old photographs that you've not yet encountered.
Well, I hope so.
Yeah. If you have just tuned in, my guest is author Ben Sanmel. His book, Ernie Cato, the R&B Emperor of New Orleans, just came out. It was published by the Historic New Orleans Collection as a part of the Louisiana Musicians series. The book is just packed with wonderful photographs, Ben's writing, and let's see, if you are in the area tonight, Ben will be reading from the book at Casa Azul in Grand Coteau.
Yeah, at 7 o'clock.
7 o'clock, and he will have copies of the book, and he'll be signing the book. Yvette Landry will be performing afterwards. Maybe she'll even do a rousing chorus.
Well, I'm sure she would be well qualified, and yeah. I could mention, the book website is ErnieCatoBook.com, and one story that I think people might be tickled by is when my book on Zydeco came out, the book that I did with Rick Olivier, we invited Cato to the book signing party, and it was at a fine art photography gallery. The atmosphere was a little stiff, and the people looked a little taken aback when he and his wife walked in these very elaborate matching outfits and big hairdos, also matching. And he worked the crowd for about a minute, and then he went over to the table and sat down and started signing the books, which he had not written, which was not about him. But in his mind, if a crowd was gathered, it had to be for Ernie Cato. So we didn't try and stop him. We thought it was great. We encouraged him. And I wish I still had one of those books with his autograph. Addition to mine, but other people snagged them.
So he was a very particular personality, sort of born out of New Orleans, of the kind of music he performed.
Well, he was a very particular personality in a sense, but he also, to me, really embodied a lot of New Orleans traditions. And New Orleans is a city of flamboyance and spectacle, and it's a city that celebrates eccentricity rather than discouraging it or marginalizing people who are eccentric. So in a lot of ways, Cato is a logical, if extreme, extension of a certain New Orleans spirit. And he was also grew up with some very flamboyant New Orleans traditions. He himself was a Mardi Gras Indian for 12 years. So he was involved in a lot of likewise, you know, similar traditions of flamboyance and extreme celebration and spectacle.
Any culture that spends an entire year creating a costume and then remakes it the next year.
Yes, yes.
Is very comfortable with that.
Very comfortable with that. And, it's, you know, if he had been raised in Omaha or Cincinnati, where I grew up, people would just have thought he was a kook, I think.
Mm-hmm. But in New Orleans?
Well, and also he was a really good musician, because there are no end of flamboyant, there's no end of flamboyant kooky people in New Orleans, but that would not really be the basis for writing a book. And also New Orleans is really rich with great New Orleans rhythm and blues singers who made good records. Mm-hmm. But he combined the two, and that was what fascinated me. If he had just been a guy who had one hit record and also a great body of work that he left behind, but that in itself wouldn't have been the basis for a book, and not to me. And if he had just been an eccentric who called himself the Emperor of the Universe and walked around in flowing robes and plumage, there really are quite a few people like that on the streets of New Orleans. So that in itself would not be the reason to write a book. But combining those two, and in his long saga of early success and then decades of failure, redemption at the end is kind of a love story. It's a hero's odyssey.
Mm. Well, for those of us who actually only know that one hit,
yes,
tell us a few songs that you really do like, some of his other work.
Well, some of his other work will probably be familiar to people around here, although it wouldn't be away from the Gulf Coast. But he had a song called Tainted the Truth. He had a song called A Certain Girl, Hello, My Lover, I Have Cried My Last Tear. These were all produced by Alan Toussaint, and they came out between 1961 and 1963. And even today, bands along the I-10 circuit are required to know a lot of those songs on request. Once you get away from the Gulf Coast, the only song that people know is Mother-in-Law. Mm-hmm. Although Elvis Costello and Warren Zevon have recorded A Certain Girl. And in musical circles, Cato is known. But for the general public, really, Mother-in-Law is the only one that's known. But one thing that was important to me in doing this book was that that people realized that with the eccentricity, also a boatload of talent.
All right. Well, people can find out more about him, find his music online, I'm sure. But this book, Ernie Cato, The R&B Emperor of New Orleans, written by my guest Ben Sandmel, is available at the website, theerniecatobook.com.
And bookstores around the state.
All right. Or tonight at Casa Azul in Gran Coteau.
Yes, 7 o'clock.
7 o'clock. Ben will be reading and telling more stories about Ernie Cato.
Right.
Thank you so much, Ben.
Judith, thank you.